Good morning and welcome to our podcast. My name is David Pritchard and I'm the head of marketing here at Sintons. I'm joined today by my colleague Lee Garbutt, who is a trainee solicitor in the employment team here at Sintons. And our podcast today, which will last approximately 10 to 15 minutes, is the podcast version of issue 80 of our employment law e-bulletin, which we pushed out earlier this week. So if you do want to check out the written version, that's on our website, www.sintons.co.uk. So without any further ado, I'm going to pass you straight over to Lee. Lee, good morning and over to you.
Thanks, David, and welcome to this latest update bulletin, where we'll be discussing recent case law updates and legislation updates. In this first section, we'll be looking at Kakur versus Angard Staffing Solutions Limited, in which the Court of Appeal held that an agency worker does not have the direct right to apply for a directly employed vacancy with the hirer. In this case, it involved the Agency Worker Regulations 2010, which is intended to give effect to the Temporary Agency Workers Directive, in which Regulation 13(1) of the regulations is intended to implement Article 6 of the directive, which allows that temporary agency workers are eligible from day one of an assignment. Just as a snapshot, that provides that an agency worker has during an assignment the right to be informed by the hirer of any relevant vacant post with the hirer, and to give that agency worker the same opportunity as a comparable worker to find permanent employment with the hirer. The hirer may inform the agency worker by a general announcement in a suitable place in the hirer's establishment. In this case, the claimant worked for Angard Staffing Solutions, which is a subsidiary of Royal Mail, in which he worked for Royal Mail, outlined the demands for work for the claimant. He was given regular work with Royal Mail, who determined his work and conditions of employment. However, the claimant alleged breaches of the agency workers' regulations, specifically in relation to the advertised internal vacancies by Royal Mail. In this scenario, the internal vacancies were put on a notice board within the Royal Mail building, in which operators in permanent posts were allowed to apply. However, agency workers were not eligible to apply for the posts until they were advertised externally. However, in this scenario, the claimant argued that when those posts went externally, of course, the claimant would be in the wider pool with all external candidates. Therefore, the claimant argued that Regulation 13 of the agency workers' regulations had been breached because he was not able to apply for those internal vacancies, along with the permanent workers who were able to do so. The Employment Tribunal held in the first instance that not only did the agency workers' regulations include the right to receive the same level of information as permanent workers, it also included the right to apply directly to the hirer and be considered in the same way. However, once this progressed to the Employment Appeal Tribunal, subsequently on appeal by the claimant, the Employment Appeal Tribunal disagreed, stating that it did actually extend to the right to apply for the internal vacancies as well as being informed of those vacancies at the same time. The Court of Appeal reaffirmed the Employment Appeal Tribunal's position and essentially stated that if the agency workers' regulations intended the right to apply for a vacancy, it would have stated this within the regulations, and the regulations do not provide for this provision. It is simply that they must be informed of a general announcement in a suitable place by the hirer's establishment. Points to note from this case is that agency workers are not in every way comparable with permanent workers under the directive, and it is useful confirmation for employers that the regulation will be complied with if agency workers are notified and provided with information about the vacancies and not necessarily given the right to apply directly for that vacancy. Moving on to legislation updates, of course, COVID-19 has provided for many updates over the last couple of years in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. And final changes are now coming into play in relation to statutory sick pay. The government previously implemented measures to allow for individuals deemed to be incapable of work and therefore entitled to receive statutory sick pay when they were self-isolating or shielding, and reduced the days from incompatible at day 4 to day 1. However, the recent changes in relation to statutory sick pay for COVID-19 has now disapplied those temporary measures that were brought in by the government. And as of the 25th of March 2022, the statutory sick pay General Coronavirus Amendment Regulations 2022 have been revoked. Essentially, this means that statutory sick pay individuals must now be sick or incapable of work, meaning that those who were previously asymptomatic or only have very mild symptoms will no longer be able to claim for statutory sick pay even when they test positive. And as mentioned previously, statutory sick pay no longer starts from day one of an employee's absence relating to COVID-19, but now has reverted back to that fourth day of absence. Moving finally on to the final section of the bulletin update, recent case law involving Waters versus the Moat Cricket Club. This essentially held that a worker operating through their own business was not entitled to holiday pay as he was not classed as a worker or employee. In this case, the Employment Tribunal held that the claimant, Mr. Waters, was essentially running his own business and was therefore not in a position to claim for holiday pay due to his employment status. In this scenario, the claimant was working with the Moat Cricket Club and was offered a contract by the club on a contractor basis. The facts around Mr. Waters' business is that he operated his own gardening business, which he set up in 2011. He engaged with the club in relation to the upkeep of its cricket pitches. In summary, the case involved the claimant working around 60 hours per week in the summer months in the upkeep of the cricket pitches, 40 of which to be carried out by Mr. Waters personally. Mr. Waters attempted to renegotiate the terms of the contract with the club. However, this was unsuccessful, which ultimately led to the termination of the contract with the club. Following this, Mr. Waters decided to submit a claim for holiday pay and notice pay on the basis that he was a worker or an employee due to the control that the club had over his work. As mentioned, preliminary hearing with the Employment Tribunal held that he was in fact not an employee or a worker. And this was due to a number of considerations and conclusions that were made. Amongst other things, Mr. Waters was not under control or any supervision by the club. He was expected to provide his own equipment from time to time. And he also engaged other individuals who provided work under his contract with the club. Following this, Mr. Waters appealed to the Employment Appeal Tribunal, which dismissed his appeal. Albeit he was sometimes required to carry out additional work, the Employment Appeal Tribunal found this was not a key factor in determining whether or not he was a worker. Even though a person might enter into a contract where it might be necessary to perform additional work, there will be no further remuneration sometimes in those cases, which is consistent with someone that is self-employed or obviously operating a business in their own account. As there was no fixed start and finish times, which might be common with employment, the Employment Appeal Tribunal held that the Employment Tribunal was entitled to find this was consistent with someone that was not an employee or a worker. As there was no control or monitoring that you would find with someone who was in employment, again, this was consistent with someone that was in business on their own account. Key points to note from this recent update is again in relation to determining the employment status of an individual. Again, this will be determined on very specific facts, which can change from case to case. Courts will have to really consider the reality of the working arrangements, along with any written contract that might be involved. And again, in this case, as the claimant was already running his own business when he contracted with the club, this was a determining factor. Not only does this highlight an individual's status must be determined on a case-by-case basis, again, it highlights the importance of ensuring that each individual has the correct label that truly reflects the relationship with the organisation involved. If this is incorrect, it can bring exposure to a number of employment tribunal claims, as well as tax and national insurance liabilities. That's all in this HR bulletin update. Thanks very much for listening, and I'll hand back to David.
Thanks, Lee. Enjoyed listening to that one. Can't believe we're actually on episode 80 of the Employment Bulletin. Very quickly for me, as usual, we release our webinars, podcasts and blogs on a regular basis, all of which can be found on our website, www.sintons.co.uk, should you wish to take a look. And obviously that includes all episodes of the monthly Employment Law Bulletins. And you can also follow the employment team on Twitter, should you wish, at SintonsHR. If you'd like to discuss anything Lee's raised today further, please don't hesitate to get in touch with him or a member of the team. Lee can be contacted via telephone 0191 226 7878 or via email lee.garbutt@sintons.co.uk. Thank you once again for listening. We look forward to connecting with you next month for episode 81. Stay safe, everyone. Thanks for listening.